Okay, this is the Quiet in the Land bar scene, take one.
And at Island Blues and Shine is the German expression, you avoid even just the appearance of evil, I guess that's it.
15 seconds to dissolve.
So you probably don't know the voice talking over the voices that I'm also talking over.
We dissolve right when he says, can I...
The one giving the orders as if he's directing live television. In fact, he's making a radio program.
We were even discouraged to go into
one and dissolve.
He's got fans all over the world, but if they know him, they probably know him better like this. That's how I first heard him, in the summer of 1956, on a friend's rather beaten-up LP, playing, or perhaps a better word is, transfiguring Bach's Goldberg Variations. A 23-year-old, almost unknown Canadian pianist named Glenn Gould. He had a James Dean profile and extremely strange mannerisms. You could hear him humming along as he played, or the piano stool creaking as he swayed his body to and fro. But the playing was exciting. Dangerous, sexy, and liberating. Ten years on, this astonishing performer had given up concerts and turned his back on the public. The eccentric Mr. Gould, overcoat in midsummer, bottles of pills on the piano, serial insomnia, never wanted to put himself through what he called the blood sport of live performance again. Studio recording was what he believed in now, and recording not just notes, but voices.
I can remember the time I was going north from Connacht. It was a stick with fun. As a matter of fact, I think he'll cut it out in blocks and pass it over the stern to get ahead.
I'm never no good at the weather. I think weather is a lot of it is your luck.
From Big Bertha and the gals of the MS Vagabond, riding at anchor just a cozy quarter mile beyond the international limit, Pet Clark with that question we've all been asking. I walk alone and wonder, who am I?
Thus far, Mr. Glenn Gould on Petula Clark.
Between 1967 and 1978, Glenn Gould made a series of radio documentaries, some about music, some about places, all about journeys. And the same man who woke me up to music when I was 18 now woke me up to the possibilities of radio, just as I was starting to produce for the BBC. He showed me that making radio can also be about making music. And I became more and more intrigued by Gould himself. What made this complicated, obsessive genius tick? And what I want to do in this radio journey is look at him, not through his piano playing, but through his radio work, to get behind the contradictions and perhaps get a glimpse into Gould's mind.
There's a very interesting photo in North which showed children in Alaska on the Kuskokwim looking at a television set for the first time. And what they were seeing on the television set were themselves. They had a closed circuit rigged up. I suppose, you know, in Einstein's term, if space is curved...
Every creative endeavour is a window on a wider world and a mirror to oneself, because you're looking essentially across a boundary between yourself and other people or other phenomena.
Jim Lotz was one of the famous five, the original voices, in Gould's first full-scale radio documentary, The Idea of North.
And I think that's what Glenn Gould was striving for. He was trying to break out of the traditional way of doing documentaries. But at the same time, being the person he was, I think he was very conscious that it was something about him, the loneliness, the emptiness, the silence. That might have been something in him that was... he was looking for in other people and in the North.
I don't go, let me say this again, I don't go for this Northmanship bit at all.
Because it just seemed endless.
I don't...
we seem to be going into nowhere.
Not those people who do claim that...
And the further north we went,
farther north and so on.
More monotonous.
But I see it as a kind of a game, this Northmanship bit, with people saying...
I said idea of North, but it was rather more idea than North. One December night in 1967, listeners to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's Ideas slot were astonished to hear five people talking about emptiness, and often at the same time.
Anyone being in close touch with the North, whether he lived there all the time or simply traveled it.
Nothing quite like it had been heard before on the Canadian airwaves, and no one quite like Gould had ever got his hands on a CBC tape recorder. It was Janet Somerville who commissioned him to make Something Beautiful for radio.
It was already completely in Glenn's mind. Every pulse of that hour was already there. The interviews were already done. I didn't do the interviews. I mean, I didn't arrange them. The music with which it was fused was already chosen. And the experiment to use the spoken interview voices, from which Glenn, by the way, took himself out completely. You know, they were free-flowing monologues as far as anyone listening was concerned. They came in over each other and under each other and sometimes continued together for some time. At one point, some of the music critics who came to see us were describing it as aleatoric sound. But it couldn't be less aleatoric. Everything was foreseen, foreknown, planned, and whittled down to exactly the right pulse and beat and rhythm to sustain this synthesis that had been brewing in Glenn's mind for I don't know how long.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of Via Rail Canada, I welcome you for train number 668 en route to Montreal and train number 648 en route to Ottawa.
The idea of North was the first in a trilogy of radio documentaries about solitude. This one was set on a train journeying into the Canadian wilderness. The sound of the train runs under everything, rising and falling with the voices, sometimes overwhelming them. John McGreevy, then a young film student, was equally overwhelmed.
It was 1967. There were all sorts of interesting things happening in an otherwise stultifying culture and country. And along comes Gould with an entirely radical approach to radio documentaries, the idea of North. It was very well promoted by the CBC, and I remember taking time out. I wasn't yet a filmmaker, I was still learning, but I remember taking time out that evening, turning the lights off in my apartment, and lying down and listening to this. I knew it required close attention, and it was unlike anything I had previously heard on radio. And I thought it was a genius piece of architecture, the structuring and the blending of various voices. A lot of it went over my head at the time, but I marveled at its innovativeness, you know, and what he was endeavoring to do. And it did give a haunting portrait of a rather bleak part of the world. That train journey to Fort Churchill and back, a place that I learned later that Gould was actually infatuated with.
Well, I didn't think it was eccentric to go north. Many people who knew me thought it was. They couldn't see my point at all. They didn't think it was a country for a woman, especially for a single woman, because they thought about the social life there and thought that when a woman reaches a certain age, she should be far more concerned with trying to trap a man than with making a career for herself or with trying to face the world by herself.
I think it takes a strong person to live in the North and really to be a part of it and to find satisfaction there. When you're living in the big city in the South, you can always retreat. When you fail in your relations with society, you can just go away.
Infatuation plus a coolly analytical mind. Documentary as drama. Gould saw himself, I think, as an author in search of characters. Here he is introducing the idea of North.
I suppose really that all authors do interview the characters that they invent, and if and when the characters manage to achieve a life of their own, they in turn describe the author for us. And by the same token, there is something inherently dramatic, it seems to me, in that most familiar of the documentary stocks in trade, the tape-recorded interview. Spontaneous, unscripted, full of surprises and reverses, interviewees have been known to turn into interviewers upon the moment. They are, or can be, the raw material of drama. Once we'd selected the five guests for the program, it was relatively a simple matter to get them to agree or disagree with each other. All we had to do was to ask each of them the same question, and since, as anyone who has had much experience of the Arctic can tell you, no two people will respond to that experience in anything like the same way, there was, in their diverse reactions to these questions, an inherently dramatic climate of disagreement. Jim Lotz, for instance, emphasized the virtue of solitude.
The thing about the North, of course, in personal terms, is that in the North you feel it's so big, it's so vast, it's so immense, it cares so little. And this sort of diminishes...
I was stereotyped, I think, as the enthusiast. Bob Phillips was stereotyped as the bureaucrat, and boy, did he sound bureaucratic. And Frank Valli was the demythologizer. Hey, you know, I done 10,000 miles by dog team, that sort of thing. And the nurse was the kind of gentle, wandering presence. As I saw it, it's as if he was writing a fugue. He took us all as separate pieces of music, if you will, and welded them into a fugue.
When Glenn Gould gave up live concerts in 1964, he knew he was free to make music the way he wanted. Except he'd missed the boat when it came to being a composer in the conventional sense. John Peter Lee Roberts, head of radio music at CBC in those days.
So what he realized was that as he was not going to be a composer, which was a very bitter disappointment to him, that he could be another sort of composer, composing with words. So he hit upon the idea of using voices in counterpoint. He did so actually from a very practical point of view because he had too much material for the idea of North. And the only way he could get the most important parts of what he had taped in was by telescoping them. And in doing so, he realized that he was onto something new and special.
He referred to it, I think, as contrapuntal radio. So I think he wanted to create a sound world of parallel texts.
Composer Matthew King.
Where you would listen to one person speaking and then you'd tune in as if you yourself were a radio in a funny way to another voice and then to another voice. So it's a different way of listening. He wanted people, I think, to have this more postmodern approach to listening, possibly, where you pick and mix from what you're listening to. You can't possibly listen to three concurrent people speaking. That information can't be comprehended in that way.
Anyone being in close touch with the North, whether he lived there all the time or simply traveled it month after month, year after year, I can't conceive of such a person being really untouched by the North for the rest of his life. When I left in 1960...
The first night that we broadcast North, CBC received several phone calls from puzzled listeners saying that they couldn't get the station accurately. What was the matter with the transmission? Because they couldn't get one sound. Well, no.
I actually have the fault report from the master control that night, and it's got written on it from various places across the country. Crosstalk was the complaint in the program. You know, and various points across the network had complained that there was crosstalk throughout the program.
Lorn Talk, that was him with producer Janet Somerville, was Gould's favourite sound engineer. Working with the maestro was the most exciting time of his life. They would edit through the night. No lights, just the glow of the dials on the recording desk. Alone in the studio, magician and apprentice, priest and acolyte, or, Janet Somerville's words, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. 100 hours to make an hour. The result was extraordinary. But was it radio?
If you listen to it on a CD and you have the luxury of listening to it several times, then it begins to be particularly interesting because you start... It's a meditative experience. You have a different way of relating to it each time. I think the problem with these programs when they were first written was that over the radio and listening live, it must have been baffling to hear this this texture of voices gradually obscuring each other.
And these are the people who are becoming the closest things that the Eskimos have to nationals.
Glenn Gould grew up at 32 Southwood Drive in a Toronto suburb, the only son of a fur salesman and an adoring mother. His next-door neighbour and best friend was Robert Fulford, now a well-known Canadian writer. For him, Gould was definitely a musical genius. He could hear the piano thundering and rippling through his bedroom wall. But the radio programmes, when they came along, were something different.
I listened to all of them at various times, and usually when they were just coming up new, and I was never much of a fan of them. They were a musician's idea that words could be abstract. And I've seen poets play with that idea 1,000 times, the poets who concrete poetry, all that kind of thing. And I find it mostly boring, and I'll glance at it now and then, but it's mostly boring to me. Now, Glenn had a version of that concept, which was that words are like music, voices are like music, and you can play them like counterpoint. Of course, he knew more about counterpoint than anyone else within 100 miles of where we're standing, and so he would play these counterpoint radio programs. And what it meant was that you knew that something clever was going on, but after a while, you didn't really know what.
A sunny September morning in Southwood Drive. People are coming out onto their porches with breakfast and newspapers. There's a plaque on the lawn outside number 32. And inside the small two-story house, 60 years ago, the radio would almost certainly have been on.
Radio wasn't exactly a passion with Glenn. It was a part of life. It was just built into you. In the 30s, it was not brand new. It was brand new in the 20s. In the 30s, he was born in 32, so it was 1935 when he would be conscious of what was being done in the house. And, of course, by then the radio was on. And by then, it was the main means of communication. It immediately became more important than newspapers, and that, of course, was accentuated by the Second World War, which poured in through radio. And he was fascinated by it. It became a sort of a lifeline for people who lived in rather boring districts such as this. And he and I, and a few people a few years older, and people a few years younger, were the first and the last radio generation.
It was listening to his car radio along Ontario's Highway 17 that Gould first heard Petula Clark.
It's a sign of the times that your love for me is getting so much stronger.
He fell in love with her, and love produced an eccentric radio monologue that gave Petula the full force of his complicated mind.
You've changed a lot somehow.
Some people hate the program In Search of Petula Clark, or simply find it hilarious. It is hilarious. And I love it.
The gap between the demonstrative attitude of the lyrics and the restraint with which Petula ministers to their delivery is symptomatic of a more fundamental dichotomy. Each of the songs contrived for her by Tony Hatch emphasizes some aspect of that discrepancy between an adolescent's short-term need to rebel and long-range readiness to conform. In each, the score pointedly contradicts that broad streak of self-indulgence that permeates the lyrics. The harmonic attitude is at all times hymnal, upright, and relentlessly diatonic.
That dry, academic, and tongue-in-cheek analysis reveals Pet Clark as the somewhat old-fashioned heroine of the 60s pop scene. The villains, as Gould saw them, are wonderfully, esoterically, and quite unfairly, rubbished.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry.
For the Beatles, a neo-triadic persuasion is, or was, a guerrilla tactic, an instrument of revolution. Annexing such vox populi conventions of English folk harmony as the greensleeves-type nonchalance of old Vaughan Williams' lethargic parallel fifths, the new minstrels turned this lovably bumbling plain speech into a disparaging mimicry of upper-class inflection. Theirs is a happy, cocky, belligerently resourceless brand of harmonic primitivism. Their career has been one long send-up of the equation, sophistication equals chromatic extension. In the Liverpudlian repertoire, the indulgent amateurishness of the musical material, though closely rivaled by the indifference of the performing style, is actually surpassed only by the ineptitude of the studio production method. Strawberry Fields suggests a chance encounter at a mountain wedding between Claudio Monteverdi and a jug band.
Well, I think that he had a very weird approach to popular music. He didn't much like it. He didn't like jazz at all. I tried to convert him. I did my best. as a missionary. I played a few jazz records for him. And, of course, he saw jazz as just the tail end of romanticism and a very boring thing altogether. And I stopped after a while. But later on, when he decided he liked Petula Clark, who was really, in my opinion, kind of a zero musically, although a kind of an annoying sound in the background, I thought.
What was the Petula interest? Do you think he was just doing that as a pose, or he genuinely loved it?
I don't think he would bother to do it as a pose. I think he probably got involved in it. And then he realized it would look ridiculous when he came out with it. But then he said, what the hell, I don't care. Why am I caring? So then he let it out, published it, or whatever he did. He was sort of that way. He wouldn't pretend to be anything he wasn't. And he wasn't really going to hide anything he was, as far as in terms of music.
As he hums his way through the 1977 recording of Bach's English Suites, crouched below the keyboard on his father's homemade piano stool, the record sleeve shows a brooding philosopher with graying sideburns, Glenn Gould has become the most famous Canadian after media guru Marshall McLuhan. And that got him places. Janet Somerville.
Working with Glenn Gould on a CBC project was a little different from working on other projects, because we got hundreds of hours of studio time without any argument. And believe me, getting extra studio time back in those days when we were crammed into this little building on Jarvis Street was a major. It sometimes took 4, 5, 6, 7 phone calls to get extra studio time. But when Glenn Gould's name was on the requisition sheet, you got studio time. The CBC was committed to this Canadian phenom.
The phenom was a parcel of paradoxes. Control freak, dreamer. Hypochondriac, risk-taker. Introvert, sharp businessman. No wonder the men in suits found him baffling. John Peter Lee Roberts.
I said, Glenn, you know, I've got a great idea. I said, why don't you incorporate yourself? He was already incorporated as a company, Glenn Gould Limited. And I said, you buy the equipment, and we, CBC, will agree to buy back from you over a period of years a certain number of documentaries every year, a certain number of piano recitals or chamber music, whatever you want to do, so that you are not taking any financial risk whatsoever. And in fact, you're paving the way for a richer future. So that's what we did. When the CBC contract department drew up the contract, I must tell you it was hilarious, because they felt that Glenn was a complete nut. He was sort of insane. And they had all kinds of clauses in there to protect the corporation. And I just took a pen and went through them like this. And I said, what are you doing? I said, I don't want you to even read it. And he said, oh, I must see, I must see. So when he read the contract, he really laughed, but he understood why I'd done it.
Glenn Gould's second excursion into contrapuntal radio was called The Latecomers. No train this time, but another semi-musical inspiration, the sound of the sea, sucking and boiling around the voices, sometimes drowning them. The subject, as always, was solitude. And the setting? Newfoundland.
This thing that has happened to you and me has happened to us over a period of 100 years, you know. The mad rush of this life has robbed us of the solitude. And really, the value of life comes from solitude. The real knowledge. Be still and know, if you want to text me. Be still and know. Modern civilization came in over a long period of years and robbed us of the meditation. and solitude and quietude and so forth. Robbed us all. We didn't know what was happening to us. That's what we wanted.
You might say that Gould himself was playing on the instrument of these voices. That's the effect it sometimes has. He uses his recorded material almost like the keys of a piano. He's almost playing them, playing the contributors. And in one sense, I suppose, it's almost sinister, isn't it? The way that he manipulates the edit so that it becomes musical. I mean, that's unfair. It's not really sinister. It's just very individual.
All documentary makers manipulate their material, to use Matthew King's word. Life is constantly cut up and rearranged, but for Gould, that rearrangement became an art form. To him, the world was one vast musical score.
It has occurred to me in the last few years that it's entirely unrealistic to see that particular kind of work, that particular ordering of phrase and regulation of cadence, which one is able to do taking, let us say, the subject of an interview like this one to a studio after the fact and chopping it up and splicing here and there and pulling on this phrase and accentuating that one and throwing some reverb in there and adding a compressor here and a filter there, that it's unrealistic to think of that as anything but composition, that it really is, in fact, composition. I think our whole notion of what music is has forever merged with all the sounds that are around us, you know, everything that the environment makes available. And in that sense, I think that the contrapuntalists, especially the Renaissance contrapuntalists, and Bach as he represented them historically, in a sense, were the first practical men as composers. They were the first people who recognized that it was possible and feasible and realistic to expect the human mind and the human ear to be aware of many simultaneous relationships, to follow their diverse courses, and to be involved in all of them.
Write with at least two sound sources, usually one TV program, one radio program, in the background, but I guess in the middle ground would be more accurate. And if I go to a restaurant, I find myself automatically disentangling three or four conversations from nearby tables, whatever. So I think the capacity is unlimited. I think everyone's capacity to do that is unlimited, but largely untapped, because most drama, even drama that explores various levels of reaction to the same situation, you know, still uses a predominantly linear format.
I find it hard enough sorting out the voices in a musical fugue, let alone the sounds of the modern world. However hard are eavesdropping, cafes, bars, trains, parks, as Glenn Gould did. So many things at once, I can't hear what he heard, or what he wanted to hear after he'd collected his material. For Lorne Tulk, who engineered the idea of North and the latecomers, those late-night editing sessions must have been a bit like weaving the Bayeux tapestry.
We'd sit down and he'd often say, well, you know, he would place people in a particular spot in the spectrum. And oftentimes he placed them because they were a very right-leaning or a very left-leaning person, so he would put them in that area, for that was part of his reasoning. But when it came to time, that was when our collaboration would work more together, and he'd say, I want to move this person from here, or I think I want to move them over to here and here. What do you think would be the best way of doing it? You know, and we would go over the script, and he would then give me the idea of what he was trying to get at, and I would sort of suggest possible ways or how we could move them. But again, what he didn't want to do was sort of move things too quickly. You know, he wanted things to go gently so that it was not an abrupt change to you, the listener, who's never seen this. We've been over the script 100 times. So that was the point that he was trying to make.
Making points was one of Gould's specialities. Even an apparently live on-air exchange with an announcer or interviewer was minutely prepared and calculated. Take this bizarre appearance on a CBC sports show. Topic for the evening, the famous Canada versus USSR ice hockey matches.
One result of the series will undoubtedly be a re-evaluation by the hockey moguls of the Western world of the intricate, anti-individualistic playmaking of the Russian team. Another result has been the decision by the production team responsible for the scene to commission the following comments on the games from Glenn Gould.
Thank you, Harry.
Allow me to read that last line again with appropriate italics. To commission the following comments on the games from Glenn Gould.
You presume to question my competence in the field, sir?
In the field, perhaps not, but in the gondola, as Foster Hewitt might say, I most certainly do.
May I remind you, sir, that no red-blooded Canadian boy could be oblivious to the high stakes devolving upon the Russia-Canada confrontation.
No, that's quite true, but since you're presumably not just here to ice the puck, as we say at penalty-killing time, I can only assume, Glenn, that you're about to fire a slapshot at some particular goal of your own.
That I am, Harry.
Well, why don't we have a face-off, then, and see who gets control of the puck?
Fair enough. Actually, I do have a particular...
Glenn Gould and Harry Brown in a CBC sports series with no joke unrehearsed. German composer, writer and radio producer Michael Stegemann has watched Gould's grip from the beginning.
Since the middle of the 1960s, Gould has written for any interview and for any TV program and for any radio interview he gave the questions and the answers. So the people who were with him, they all had to follow Gould's questions. And in fact, that gives something quite strange for even the jokes. In these things, Gould has planified them all than himself. There's nothing spontaneous. He hated to be spontaneous. That's why he hated concert giving. He wanted the perfect ideal state of his mind or of his aesthetics. And so he didn't want to leave anything for hazard. And that's why questions and answers are all Gould.
That was very much Glenn. I mean, Glenn's second name, I think, if I were honest, is control. You know, he really wanted to and had control of everything.
Fair enough. Actually, I do have a particular angle that I want to play, and
which I, as the opposition goalie, will of course attempt to cut off.
Okay, but I got to warn you that from long years of practicing glissandi, I've got a mean backhand, so watch it on the rebounds.
Well, may I suggest that before you get any further offside and we run out of double entendres, that you get to the point.
Well, I would, but my left winger isn't paying attention.
Having a little trouble with the controls there.
This side of Glenn Gould, the Hamlet who wanted to play the clown, could take him much further. I'm not sure which is him in this surreal bit of radio, but I think he's the one making the loudest silly plane noises. Had he been listening to the Goon Show?
Of a U-2 reconnaissance plane flying over the Soviet Union. They don't know I'm here. I took off this morning from a base in Pakistan. The Pakistanis didn't know I was going.
Parody was one of Gould's favorite party tricks, even if it wasn't his greatest talent.
I'd like to talk to you for 55 seconds about 2 hours of radio called CBC Tuesday Night. For 25 years, this distinguished...
For a series of TV trails, he decided to raid his cupboard of spoof establishment figures.
Artists of our time. Artists like the Dean of British Conductors, Sir Nigel Twitt Thornwaite, subject of a forthcoming CBC Tuesday Night documentary entitled Fred Delius, Knew My Father.
I should just like to say to you all that CBC Tuesday Night is rather like Radio 3 at home, don't you know? Although my mother's surprised to learn that in the colonies they have it only once a week, it seems. So it is incumbent upon all of us to put our very best feet forward. So if you're quite ready then, and Shelley, do watch for the subdivided V, won't you? Here we go then. 3, 4, and...
For portraits of great artists like Sir Nigel Twitt Thornwaite...
Composers also got the Gould treatment. I wonder what the late avant-garde composer Karlheinz Stockhausen would have made of his so-called reductionist namesake, Karlheinz Klopfweiser.
But I am convinced that my work, which is concerned with the resonance of silence, verstehen Sie? But moreover, with German silence, which is, of course, organic, as opposed to French silence, which is ornamental, since my work can only be properly understood, seen in a proper perspective in the radio.
For perspective on Karlheinz Klopfweiser and other great artists of our time.
He was like the guy who watches Seinfeld do it on stage, and then he thinks he could do it too. You know, he was a little like that. He wasn't funny imitating a German musician or a, you know, conductor or whatever. I don't think he was funny, but when he talked to you, he was lighthearted. He was very lighthearted about most of the things. Most of the things he did, you know, he would talk once you got into the middle of discussing a piece that he was going to play. He was serious, but most of the time, talking about his teachers and about the conservatory and all those things, he was quite lighthearted.
He had a very intellectual sense of humor, so a joke for him was something that was very cerebral and you had to think about. And it was very rare that, especially me, caught up with them. So I don't remember us having many jokes. But he had this corny side about him, too. He liked very corny stuff. So, you know, if I can say that, and I think I can, you know.
Yeah, well, I can relate to what you're saying, man, but, like, not with any negative vibes, you know, because as far as I'm concerned, when you're dealing with middle Mozart there, you go mainly for the beach, you know, like...
Another of Gould's creations, Mumbling Theodore Sluts. For all its occasional naffness, Gould's zany sense of humour could come in very handy. John McGreevy made use of it in a film he made with him about Toronto, particularly when they got to the zoo.
Well, he describes, when we visited the zoo very early in the morning, how a while earlier he was walking down a country lane singing and noticed the cows paying attention. And so he picked up the volume and they moved closer to him. And he thought, this was remarkable. He'd never had such an attentive audience before, and discovered that, he claimed, a rapport with animals vastly superior to any of his concert audiences. And with that in mind, we decided that he would sing Mala Lida to the elephants. Well, they weren't quite that excited about it.
Antonius Zurpredig, Ziegir Schert entledig, ergebt zu den Fischen und predigt den Fischen, sie schon mit den Schwänzen im Sonnenschein glänzen, im Sonnenschein, Sonnenschein glänzen, sie glänzen, sie glänzen. Die Kaken mit Rogen, seid auch hier herzogen. Habt mal euch das Rösen.
You messed up the words. That's something in a slower tempo.
It's 1977, and Glenn Gould is back in the world of radio and the last of his Solitude trilogy. The Quiet in the Land is a portrait of a religious community, the Mennonites of Red River, Manitoba. No trains, no sea, not many overlapping voices. For me, this is Gould's finest radio program, and up there with his playing of the Goldberg Variations. For once, there's time to breathe.
We live in a society which is geared to making money, to preserving an American or Canadian way of life, without ever really examining the specifics of these. There are obviously many good things about an apple pie existence, but is it the only thing that I want to do? Are there more important things? See, we've been basically an agriculturally oriented people until about 30, 40 years ago, when the Mennonites began to move into the city, as did everyone else in this country. And one of the things that I see happening in the Mennonite group is a growing materialism. I like to think that I'm not a materialist. I hope I'm not. I'm afraid I am all too often materialistic in my choices.
We just bought ourselves a new house. We bought a house with a lot of waste space in it. And it's not functional. It's got a very grand staircase and so on. It uses up a lot of room. I think it's partly that I've grown up in a society where things were very functional, and I'm reacting against that.
We've become terribly enamored of our things, of our homes and our cars and skidoos and boats and color televisions. And I think with it, we've lost a certain value that we used to have. We're now a part of the city, and we are faced with problems and pressures that we haven't had until a generation ago.
A Mercedes Benz.
For him, he's not interested in the personality. He's not even interested in the ideas they tell. But for him, I think it's the same as if he uses an excerpt of a Janis Joplin song or of a Bach suite for violoncello. The voices, the sounds of nature and the music all together, they are just the material for him to compose in a maybe Bachian way, in a contrapuntal way, his idea of North and his idea of Canadian life.
I think that, you know, I feel I'm a part of a community called Mennonite, and I don't feel any strong nostalgic attachment to it. I could very easily move tomorrow, I think, to a city like Hamburg, which I lived in for 1 year, and stay the rest of my life and not, I think, really miss home. We didn't miss it when I was there for a year. But I feel there's a strong community element in the Christian faith as well. I think the fact that Jesus gathered 12 people around him and gathered also some women around him seemed to help him a great deal.
Of course, as a child,
in case this is true. And
was
one of the things that I like most about the so-called Anabaptist movies. Tradition is that you work out your destiny
you
in fellowship
cards.
Of other people.
But we were able to take music lessons. We traveled. And to tell you the truth, I just don't
think the other day we had a great deal. Party at our cottage.
That I'm any
very
the poorer
close friends
for not having been able to do these things.
And we had a tremendous time. We finished.
In the world, but not of it. That's how the Mennonites talk about their lives. Glenn Gould's own position precisely. A man who could shut himself away for days in his lakeside cabin and then be on the phone to friends half the night. To people like John McGreevy, and here, his long-term assistant, Ray Roberts.
Sorry. How's that?
Do you think he'd have liked mobile phones, Glenn?
He had one.
He had one?
He had a great box in his car. It was a car phone. A great monstrous thing. He used to have to belt it and put it across the transmission hump in the car. And he used to drive around. It terrified a few people because he would sit in his car... sort of left, driving with his left foot, speaking, and often sort of semi-conducting with his right hand, and then he would have the phone propped in one of the ears or the other. He was better in the later years, but in the early years, his driving history was, shall we say, spotty.
Most of my relationships with Glenn were telephonic. Late night phone calls, and then he was utterly relaxed and at ease.
How much could you contribute to the phone call?
Hardly anything. There were monologues, and he would be off on abstruse subjects, like Scriabin versus Heidegger, or Leopold Stokowski versus Toscanini, and just go. And it was just for him an excuse to be in touch with somebody, and you just all you had to do was mumble the odd acknowledgement that you were still there.
I know everyone complains about one-sided conversations with him. I know one individual who was talking to him on the phone and fell asleep. He actually sort of got comfortable on his rug at home, laid down, and fell asleep. And his son came in and shook him. And he went, "My God." And I fell asleep on the phone. Glenn Gould picked up the phone. Glenn was still talking. I hadn't noticed.
A fascinating thing to me about Glenn was that even though people say he couldn't relate to many of his friends, he couldn't carry through a relationship, nevertheless, he could often become very friendly with a waitress or the man who tuned his piano or whatever. Anyone who he was working with, he was much friendlier than most high-class professionals or celebrities ever are. The man who tuned his piano all his life was, you know, when Glenn died, he was lost almost, because that was the most important thing in his life, this man who was mostly blind but had perfect pitch and knew how to tune the piano beautifully, and Glenn used him for years. Well, he could get somewhere with him in a way that an awful lot of intellectuals couldn't. So Glenn, in that way, had a gift for for connecting with people. But this other thing, this gift of the ability to be really close to someone and locked into their lives, I don't know if he had that.
There's a poignant scene at the end of the Toronto film which expresses this tension between public and private rather well. Gould is sheltering physically and spiritually in the dappled light shining through the windows of one of his favorite city churches.
What I've done, I think, while living here is to concoct some sort of metaphoric stained glass window, which allows me to survive what appear to me to be the perils of the city, much as I survived Monday mornings in the schoolroom, I guess. And the best thing I can say about Toronto is that it doesn't seem to intrude upon that hermit-like process. It's been fascinating to get to know it after all these years, but not even our exploration of it has made me a city convert, I'm afraid. I am more than ever convinced, though, that, like Leningrad, Toronto is indeed a truly peaceful city. But perhaps I see it through rose-colored glasses. Perhaps what I see is nothing more than mirage. I hope not, though, because if that mirage were ever to evaporate, I'd have no alternative but to leave town.
You know, what he wanted to do ultimately was start the Glenn Gould Puppy Farm. You know about the Glenn Gould Puppy Farm? Don't. All right. The Glenn Gould Puppy Farm was going to, we're going to go up to Manitoulin Island and buy a piece of Manitoulin Island and start a retirement home for animals who otherwise would be destroyed. And they had to be very selected animals that that would not eat each other, which I found a bit strange. And he also wanted Ray Robertson family to move up there. Well, that was a little bone of contention. Actually, likely that, you know, it's a nice place to visit, but I don't think I'd want to live there all the time. And but that, he actually talked about that as one of his goals in life, what he was going to do when he retired, quote, quote. So this gives a small indication that he really was into this, let's go off by ourselves and do our own thing.
At one point, Glenn wanted him and I to become brothers. And he literally wanted to go to a lawyer's office and make it legal and wanted me to be his brother. And I sort of said to him, I mean, how many times he asked that to happen, I don't know. But I said to him, you know, eventually I said, I have, you know, several other brothers and I have to ask them first. And he thought that was so dear that he never, ever really bothered me again about it. But we didn't, you know. Now, the only people who know that is Glenn and I.
Isn't it strange that great artists, when they produce work, they tend to be producing a version of themselves? So when Cézanne paints Mont Saint-Victoire, in a funny way, he's kind of doing a self-portrait, and he keeps coming back to it and coming back to it, and it somehow shows you much more about him than it does about the mountain itself, even though it's a painting of the mountain. It's a bit like that with Gould's radio programmes. Although they're about their subjects, and they're very fascinatingly about their subjects, they're even more about him, aren't they? And they're about solitude and about loneliness and about what it means to be an artist who's somehow alienated by his culture. And the programmes themselves are sort of about that topic as well.
I think he was torn on that issue of solitude. He knew that only with solitude do you find yourself and your music, but there's something else you don't find. You know, I think probably that was a part of what he was struggling with.
I think that everything in Glenn's life was about Gould. But I'm not sure that an artist can do anything else. I mean, beauty is such an inexorably demanding mistress, you know. In the same months that I was booking the studio time for North, I can't say I produced it, although that's what the credits say, because I had no influence on the program at all. At that same time, I was producing Martin Luther King's Massey Lectures. And it was an intense experience of how different it is when someone is focused on the good of a people, as Martin Luther King was completely focused on what was happening to Black Americans, versus beauty and originality. You know, they are so different. There are great people who understand how the one needs the other, and those moments of interstices when beauty and justice suddenly stand up and sing together, you know. But Glenn was all beauty and originality, and what mattered was that the tapes would bear faithful witness to what was in his inner ear, his magnificent inner ear, which could hold 18 layers of sound at the same time, you know. He certainly was a genius, but he didn't have any energy left for what was happening to the people.
Good evening and welcome to Book Time. Tonight we'll present the final program in our series of celebrated Canadians reading their favorite story. Our reader tonight is Glenn Gould.
The Three-Cornered World was written in 1906, but its action, if one can use that term with regard to so static a work, is set 2 years earlier, at the time of the Russo-Japanese War.
When Glenn Gould died in a Toronto hospital on October the 4th, 1982, there were two books on his bedside table, the Bible and the English translation of a Japanese novel by Natsume Soseki, The Three-Cornered World.
Going up a mountain track, I fell to thinking. Approach everything rationally and you become harsh. Pull along in the stream of emotions and you will be swept away by the current. Give free rein to your desires.
This brief novel tells the story of an artist who, like Gould, tries to be true to himself and his inner voice, but finds he has to open up to the affections of the world. Glenn Gould never managed that last bit, which is maybe why he was so haunted by the book and by its ending, where the hero finally breaks through to the beautiful girl whom he's met at the beginning of the novel and wants to paint, and she suddenly becomes accessible to him. Gould scholar Junichi Miyazumi.
The Three-Cornered World is a novel of an artist who was tired of secular world and who decided to see everything like a picture in detachment. And at the last end of the novel, something happened, and he found compassion, feeling of compassion in her face. And she said, that's it, you have the compassion, and now I can make a picture. And the novel is over.
Something I don't like at all about myself and all the other people who knew him is that we bought his story, that he was this, oh, just goofy guy. He goes out in the middle of summer with a big scarf on and thick gloves, you know, and he's goofy. And no one worried about him. No one ever said, look, this guy, you know, he's in a lot of pain. There's a lot of trouble here. And I don't know whether it would have helped if we'd known that, but I hated that we didn't even know that. We thought another goofy guy is a genius. Well, why not? That's how everyone talked about him. I think paranoia is something that can just take you right off the planet, right into right into madness, and he certainly had some of that.
That 1981 recording of the Goldberg Variations was the last thing released in Klingel's lifetime. He'd come full circle, 26 years on from his first explosive version of the same work. But this is a darker, more inward performance, and I doubt if Gould died a happy man. Perhaps he never was. His radio work shows even more clearly, I think, than his piano playing, an enormous and troubled talent, much more interested in ideas than in people, in concepts than stories, in his view of the world, rather than the world itself. And he had something that sets him apart from most of his musical and radio contemporaries, a prophetic grasp of what technology could do for us. The 21st century wouldn't have surprised him at all. He'd have loved it.
I think technology exercises a charity upon which we have not yet reflected. There is a real charity in the machine, because it is there to help man. Of course it can be perverted. In that way, we are not very free among our creations. But in itself, it is good. It is the network of machines and techniques that encompasses the earth. It is the ensemble of all the networks, radio network, television network, oil network, hydraulic network, railroad network, telephone, telegraph, and all of that, so that it is impossible to consider a machine as isolated from the rest. It is part of all the rest, so that there is only one machine, in fact, encompassing the earth, and that has a meaning. That machine, stemming from the activity of man, is between man and nature like a second nature, offering to us its mediation. We cannot go to nature now without going through the network. Just as in the spiritual, we have to go through the Lamb. Okay, end of quote. What say you?